Support for Iditapod, a production of Alaska Public Media, comes from MVFCU. Experience the MVFCU way.
Get as much food into them as I can, and massages, and yeah, everything to make them feel good and 100% again, hopefully.
Welcome to the Iditapod, a podcast about what else? Feeling good on the Iditarod, and sometimes about feeling bad. I'm your host, Casey Grove. Before we get in touch with our feelings, how about a word from our sponsor?
Support for Iditapod 2020 comes from Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, taking pride in its strong ties to Alaska's communities.
The Iditapod is a production of Alaska Public Media. That was Iditarod musher Jesse Royer, last year's third place finisher, to start off the show, talking to KNOM's Ben Matheson in Takotna. That is where she decided to take her mandatory 24-hour layover. We have more about the mushers strategizing with those 24s, as well as a story from Alaska Public Media's Tegan Hanlon on Iditarod rookie Sean Underwood. He got a last-second nod to take four-time champion Jeff King's team out on the trail. Also have another fun piece from Ben and AKPM's Zachariah Hughes, AKPM being short for Alaska Public Media, about the blood moon and some aurora last night in Takotna, as well as a listener question about animals on the trail. We've talked about moose and bison, but this question about grizzly bears and the answer may surprise you. And we'll have another dog profile. It's the leader in the wild and free mushing team of Brent Sass, who just won the Yukon Quest for the third time this year, two in a row, actually. But first, how about a quick race update? It's Wednesday as I'm recording this. We got word last night that Anchorage musher Jim Lanier, the oldest competitor in this year's Iditarod at 79 years old, had scratched a little ways outside of the Rainy Pass checkpoint. According to Anchorage TV station KTUU on their website, ktuu.com, Lanier had stopped before the entrance to the actual Rainy Pass. That's the part that goes right through the mountains, not where the lodge called the Rainy Pass Lodge and the checkpoint are at Puntilla Lake. It's before the run through the Dalzell Gorge. Lanier had been hardly moving for about 6 hours. As KTUU reports, every other team in the race behind him had passed Lanier, and a concerned handler called the Rainy Pass Lodge to tell them that they were worried. A stop at that point was not part of the plan, so a snow machiner set out to find Lanier. He did find him, and Lanier told him that he could not get his dogs to mush up a steep hill, and after that he had gotten cold and tired. The snow machiner took Lanier back to the checkpoint where he officially scratched at about 7:30 p.m. Tuesday due to concern for his well-being. This comes after a couple other scratches in past years that the Iditarod had decided made Lanier somewhat of a liability to himself and others who'd come to his rescue. So even though he's tough as nails and had pre-qualified for the Iditarod as a multi-time finisher of the race, Lanier had to qualify again for this year's Iditarod just like a rookie would have to. He completed the necessary miles in some mid-distance races and then some by finishing the Yukon Quest last year. Obviously, this is a major bummer for Jim Lanier to have to scratch this year, but at least he and his dogs are okay and hopefully plenty warm and rested by now. And speaking of the Yukon Quest, that other 1,000-mile race, which goes from Fairbanks to Whitehorse in Canada's Yukon Territory or vice versa as the route alternates each year, reigning Yukon Quest champ Brent Sass was out in front of the Iditarod for a period of time early this morning. As other teams opted to take their 24-hour breaks earlier in Takotna, Sass continued. Here's some tape. It's courtesy of Iditarod insider of Sass stopping only shortly in Takotna to take the lead.
Welcome to Takotna.
Thank you. Glad to be here. I'm just flowing through.
Okay. Fifth number.
The food drop is right next to the straw. We're next to the straw. Okay, yeah, thank you. 44.
44.
And I got 13 dogs.
13. And you're in 243.
243. Yeah, that's not too bad. Oh, beautiful evening, huh?
Yes, it is. It must be nice running out there.
It's really good.
Sass pushed on to Ophir, where he arrived a little before 6 a.m. He was trailed by Seward's Travis Beals and Fairbanks musher and four-time Iditarod champion Lance Mackey. That lead pack did not stay in the lead for long, though, as Sass, Beals, and Mackey rested their teams in the Ophir checkpoint. And Michelle Phillips, Paige Drobny, and Mitch Seavey blew through, as they say. Phillips, a Yukoner who was SAS's main competition in the quest, actually arrived before Drobny but left a few minutes behind her. So the new trio up front is Paige Drobny, Michelle Phillips, Mitch Seavey. We'll see how that shapes up. It's always a little confusing who's really at the front of the Iditarod right now while teams take those 24-hour layovers at different checkpoints. More on that coming up. And then, of course, the time differential from the start gets added on before they can leave again. Another thing that's unclear is what's up with Nick Petit. When he arrived in Nikolai Tuesday night, he told the Anchorage Daily News that he was dropping out of the race because of an illness in his team and other problems with the dogs. He told the ADN that his whole team had been vomiting, that one dog had bitten another, and that they actually sprinted after a bison on the trail for about 2 miles. But this morning, Petit is reportedly reconsidering what sounds like a pretty serious plan to scratch the night before, after his dogs were looking a little better this morning, apparently. He told the ADN he would go checkpoint to checkpoint, with pulling out of the race still on his mind as he continued to evaluate the dogs very closely. He's been in the Nikolai checkpoint, according to the official standings, for something like 10 hours as of the time of this recording, so much more than a normal break after a run. We're not sure what his plans are, if he's taking an unplanned 24 in Nikolai or what. Usually, that's a planned thing, somewhat, as mushers might want to send certain extra supplies in their drop bags to a checkpoint where they want a 24. Sometimes, if they can afford it, they'll pack bags like that and send them to a couple, maybe three different checkpoints, so they feel comfortable making a decision on the fly about where to take the 24. Either way, most teams start thinking about that 24 somewhere after 300 or 350 miles into the Iditarod, sometimes as far as 400 miles. Jesse Royer arrived into Takotna, that's a popular spot to 24, at 11:30 Tuesday evening and quickly declared her plans to stay for 24 hours. That was after an 8.5-hour run from Nikolai. Royer said she wanted to maximize the benefit of the 24-hour break.
So I guess that's somewhat of a push, but I don't want to take too much out of them coming into a 24 because then, you know, they're not going to recuperate as much as you want to see on a 24. So you got to be careful not to take too much out or you won't get enough back.
Aniak musher Richie Deal pulled into Takotna 3 minutes after Royer. He said he was gauging his team over the previous several miles before deciding to settle in for the break.
You know, after going through the last range and stuff, this definitely seems like the right spot for them. And then, you know, the just getting hot water and going and getting a meal. I mean, it's nice and easy to operate here. Well, you know, I mean, you're maximizing your time for taking care of the dogs.
The 24-hour break means several big meals for the dogs. It's the first extended rest for the musher, and it's a chance to reset for the next stage of racing. For the next few days, mushers will leapfrog one another as they take their 24-hour breaks and different checkpoints along the trail. After that, it'll be a little bit clear who is where in the standings. Someone who is here now and that I want to bring in is Alaska Public Media's Tegan Hanlon. Hi, Tegan.
Hey, Casey.
Tegan, you've been out on the trail covering the race for several years with the Anchorage Daily News. Now, of course, you work here with us managing our Iditarod coverage on alaskapublic.org and covering oil and gas. But I wanted to ask you, what does a 24-hour layover in the Iditarod look like? What does it sound like? What does it smell like? But mostly, what does it look like?
It's actually really calm in my experience. It's interesting. You have, you know, in some cases, these villages like Takotna or these ghost towns like Ophir turn into like sled dog parking lots. Everywhere you look, there's sled dogs curled up in straw or eating. And then you have these mushers that sort of embark on these like cyclical routines over 24 hours. They're taking naps. They're getting up. They're feeding their dogs. They're feeding themselves. They're massaging their dogs. They're going back to bed. They're waking up. Repeat, repeat, repeat. You'll also see mushers take their dogs on walks so their dogs don't get sore, sort of like you or I, if we would go on a long run, sit down on the couch, you'd want to like get up and move every once in a while, even though it's tough. But yeah, it's generally quiet. Sometimes at night you'll hear dogs howling. I remember being in Takotna once and Allie Zirkle has this like party trick where she can make her dogs howl if she starts howling. So sometimes you'll hear something like that. People who live in the communities will be walking around. Takotna has a lot of pies. And so you'll kind of see mushers, which is always interesting, you know, sitting at these long wooden tables, together and, you know, talking shop, talking the trail, talking their dogs, eating burgers, eating one of a wide variety of pies. But yeah, it's just this like 24 hours of not complete stillness, but just relaxation to a degree.
It's like this big chill out. Yeah.
It is a chill out.
They get rejuvenated from that and then they're ready to hit the trail. You just reminded me actually of seeing Allie take off in the lead out of Takotna after her 24. And they did the thing. Alan Moore, her husband, was there. They got the dogs all howling and like riled up after this quiet period of time. And they were just rearing to go. And I remember she was taking off in the night because of the timing of the end of her 24. And Alan kind of slapped her on the back, was like, I love you, babe. And she just took off into the middle of the night, you know, mushing dogs. And they all looked like real energetic and ready to go. Hey, Tegan, since you're here, do you want to introduce your story about Sean Underwood?
Sure. I'd love to. So, Casey, nearly all of the mushers in this year's Iditarod signed up for the race months ago. And then there's Sean Underwood. Sean got tapped to race in the Iditarod days before it started. He took over Jeff King's team after the four-time race champion had emergency surgery last week. And then suddenly, 28-year-old Sean went from a dog handler to the musher of an all-star team in this 1,000-mile race. Here's the story. Let's start with the moment that changed Sean Underwood's winter, if not his entire life. It's last Tuesday, and Underwood is called into the office at Husky Homestead, the kennel where he works outside of Denali National Park. His boss, longtime musher Jeff King, just had surgery in Anchorage for a perforated intestine. Underwood gets on the phone and talks to King.
He called me after the surgery and told me, Sean, time to put your big boy pants on.
King said he wanted Underwood to take his place in the Iditarod. He just needed race officials to approve the change. Underwood says he couldn't believe it. The race started in 4 days.
And I spent the whole day in this weird limbo of, wait, Jeff just got out of surgery. He's probably kind of loopy. Is this real? Are you sure? It was probably not even allowed. I'm a rookie.
Hours later, Underwood got another call. Race officials had agreed to let him take over King's Iditarod team. They said Underwood knew the dogs well and had the race experience. He's completed 2 300-mile competitions plus a 200-mile one. That's enough to qualify him for the Iditarod. In that moment, Underwood was launched from a behind-the-scenes dog handler to the star of the show with a world-class team in the most famous sled dog race.
It was pedal to the metal after that. But man, I couldn't even tell you. I just was dumbfounded and speechless. And like, I've just paced back and forth in my apartment.
Underwood grew up in Atlanta and graduated from Georgia Southern University with an economics degree. He wound up on Kodiak Island in the summer of 2015 to help his aunt and uncle commercial fish. He says he fell in love with Alaska. He asked his aunt and uncle what kind of work he could get if he stayed the winter. They brought up sled dogs. They said they knew Jeff King.
When they told me he was a four-time Iditarod champion, I kind of like smiled and nodded and then waited for them to go to bed just so I could pull out my phone and Google what an Iditarod was. Okay, then I figured it out and I gave Jeff a call. And he got me a job.
Underwood started out scooping dog poop and then graduated to taking dogs on training runs. He says over the past 4 years, he's really gotten to know King's dogs.
They think of me as at least one of their dads, and they look at me anytime I'm around like, oh, there's Sean. What's he up to there? Are you going to come in and give me a little hug, maybe some love and attention? So we're really close, and I've loved them so much.
King, meanwhile, is still in the hospital recovering from surgery. Underwood says the veteran musher told him to not stress about having the perfect race schedule, to trust himself and trust the dogs. Underwood says he knows he has an excellent dog team, but he's not planning to run at the front of the pack, at least not this year.
I got a Lamborghini to work with, and I'm really excited about it, but I'm not going to be driving down the Autobahn at 200 miles an hour, I'll tell you that much.
On Sunday, Underwood and his 14-dog Lamborghini left the starting line in Willow and headed toward Nome. In Anchorage, I'm Tegan Hanlon.
Nice story. Thanks for that, Tegan. Thanks for being here, too.
Thanks, Casey. Thanks for having me. It was fun.
Okay, I'll let you go back to working the gears and the levers and the pulley system or whatever that keeps our website together. Alaska Public Media's Tegan Hanlon. Just want to mention quickly, there's an extended version of an interview that Tegan did with Sean posted on the Iditapod as a bonus episode. We like posting those extended interviews, whether from here in Anchorage or out on the trail, We also like including fun audio from our reporters out on the trail, stuff that doesn't really make sense for our normal radio broadcast. And on that note, we have a fun conversation now between Zach and Ben, taking in the sights in Takotna last night.
All right, Ben, what are we looking at?
We're looking at the biggest blood moon that I've ever seen in my life.
Ben, what is a blood moon?
It's approximately the color of one of those really old streetlight bulbs that are just like between the color of orange and red.
And it is a very full moon, and it is very big. And where are we? Where are we looking at it?
We're in Takotna outside the school. What's actually really compelling about this blood moon is how well you can see the impact craters. Like, they're extremely well-defined, dark spots that have several colors. It's not just gray.
Can you imagine, is that the aurora, or is that just clouds?
I was going to ask about that, but I think it's clouds at the moment. But look at the part just above a blood moon and see if that part moves.
I feel like it might be pulsing a little bit. A lot of stars out here too. Rob, is that the aurora over the moon?
Yeah, there's some.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, we were right. That's the northern lights over the blood moon.
I really try to keep my expectations minimal for the aurora, because the last time I was convinced I saw it, it was actually a concrete factory that was just working on overdrive.
I don't go aurora chasing, or don't go chasing aurora waterfalls, because it's laborious, and then I don't think they look that good unless they look really, really, really good, and you kind of can't do anything to predict that. And they look great in photos if you can set your camera right, but they look a little too good, if you ask me. They don't look quite like they do. And I think the coolest part is the movement, and a photograph has trouble capturing that.
If you take a look behind us, Zach, look at the difference in the sky color away from the moon compared to the sky color, you know, where the blood moon is.
In the non-blood moon section, the sky is black, and there are a ton of stars. They look beautiful. Over the blood moon is a little silvery cloud of mist that moves, unlike regular clouds, which is, I'm pretty sure that is the aurora, but very few stars, and it looks like kind of reddish.
So let's continue doing the impossible and describing gorgeous celestial events. I've switched from reading exclusively books about World War II to exclusively reading books about the Apollo program. So to have both the blood moon and what's becoming an active aurora borealis show is pretty special for me.
And to think we were just going to do some dumb snack attack with Ben and Zach, and here we are looking at the aurora over the blood moon. Also, I cannot get over how much snow is on everything in town. It's like the entire ground of the town has just been lifted up 4 feet, and all of the houses and connexes have like a yard of fluffy concrete hard white snow on top of them.
There were some kids that were just playing on this snowbank on the side of the house, but it basically attaches to where the roof line gets low, and the kids were just sliding off the roof. Tall roof, not a little small roof, two-story plus house, sliding off into the snow.
Just one of those classic Alaska moments. The Iditarod sled dog race is coming to town under a big ol' aurora-shrouded blood moon. I like to think that the man in the moon had a terrible accident, and this is his blood.
It's a pretty nice streaky aurora. Basically goes from it goes from the top of the sky towards the bottom. This is how you describe beautiful celestial events.
Let's go back in, and then we can come out later and see if it's gotten any better.
Yeah, I have to at least go see Jessie Royer come in, who's probably 7 miles away right now.
She's probably mushing under this giant moon with the aurora and no light from any nearby town, and that must be super rad.
Counterpoint, she's mushing the opposite direction from both the blood moon and the aurora, so she may be unaware.
Reverse counterpoint, she can easily turn around or stare upwards and is definitely basking in rich moonlight and is aware of its source.
Triple counterpoint, the headlamps that mushers buy sometimes have, oh, I don't know, 6 million candle power.
Reverse switcheroo counterpoint. They turn their headlamps off all the time and mush in moonlight.
Sometimes they like to keep them on too.
That's a good counterpoint, Ben. You can ask Jesse Royer in a couple of, in like an hour, whether she had her headlamp on.
It's a pretty good question. Studied 4 decades to come up with that one.
Zachariah Hughes and Ben Matheson bringing you the important news from the trail about what's going on in the sky. Okay, enough of those two jokers. Here's today's listener question.
Hi, my name is Jessica, and I'm from San Francisco. My question is about animals on the trail. So you all have been talking a lot about the moose, but I know I would be really scared of encountering a brown bear on the trail. Is that a concern for mushers at all? Are moose really the scarier animal? Thanks so much. I love the podcast. Bye.
Okay, to answer that question, I am bringing in a little bit of help from my friend, University of Alaska Fairbanks journalism professor Brian O'Donohue. Brian, how's it going?
Just great. Love listening to Diderot this time of year.
So before we attempt to answer this question, just real quick, can you tell me what your journalism and dog mushing credentials are?
Well, my journalism credentials started working for alternative papers back on the East Coast. Then I wound up taking a job at the Frontiersman here in Alaska in the mid-80s, and that's what thrust me into covering the Iditarod, and a sports writer and I gradually got dragged into the sport, Tim Mowry. He ran Iditarod, and then I did a couple years later.
You actually had, in a lesson, I remember years ago, told us about one particular bear attack on a dog musher, and when this question came in, you were the person that I thought of, and so you had reported on this bear attack. Can you tell me more about what happened and when that was?
It involved a friend of mine, Sepp Herrmann, who is German. He's a real adventurer and had worked for many years, lived and worked up in the Brooks Range. And we ran Iditarod together in 91. In about 99, he was training for the Yukon Quest. And I had loaned him a dog and a number of people. And he suddenly ran into a winter bear, a grizzly bear, in outside of Wiseman. And that bear tore into his team and killed dogs and just was a nightmare.
And I seem to recall, I think it was in November. So, you know, not in the spring, sort of more like springtime that the Iditarod happens, but certainly well into the winter in Alaska, especially up in the Brooks Range, where you would expect a bear to be hibernating. So when you say winter bear, what does that mean?
Because of the incident involving Sepp, I started looking into it, and I talked to a bunch of different native elders, one linguistics expert who came up with the word chataan, and that was an interior Athabascan term for a winter bear, a bear that does not sleep. And these are rare episodes involving bears that tend to be really old, sometimes have, you know, teeth problems, can't hibernate properly, and maybe didn't put on the amount of fat that you usually would to survive the winter. And so they wake up in the middle of the winter hungry and desperate, and there is nothing more dangerous. Once the linguist pointed me towards the term, when I would call around speaking with the elders, that immediately conjured up stories. Richard Frank of Minto told me about how he had heard in the old days this kind of bear, because it would be, you know, dragging itself around and sometimes breaking through creeks and such, would develop a sort of coat of ice in their fur. And that, reportedly anyway, was something that would deflect arrows.
So Sepp Herrmann, when this happened, was out training for the Yukon Quest. And I think I read that this bear killed all of the dogs in his team that he had with him at the time, except for one that barely survived. What happened after that?
I don't remember exactly what the casualty toll was. I know that many mushers lent him dogs, and he did wind up training and finishing Yukon Quest that year. But initially, too, after this happened, he had made it to Wisemond on foot, and an informal hunting party went out immediately and killed that bear.
Okay, well, thanks to University of Alaska Fairbanks journalism professor Brian O'Donohue, my former college advisor, also a former dog musher himself, author of the books My Lead Dog is a Lesbian and Honest Dogs. Brian, thanks for being here.
Hey, no problem. Great to talk to you, Casey.
What a wild story. To be clear, a winter bear is very, very rare, as most bears will be hibernating during most of dog mushing season. So running into a moose, or like in the Iditarod that sometimes happens, a bison, is much more common. Anyway, a good question, maybe a surprising answer. As always, please send those questions to iditarod@alaskapublic.org. The best way to do that is to record yourself on a voice memo. iPhones have a voice memo app. I believe other smartphones have them too. Tell us where you are, tell us who you are, and send that question to, again, iditarod@alaskapublic.org. That bear attack story sure brought things down a little bit, didn't it? So let's go out on a high note. How about today's dog profile? It's Jeep, a lead dog in Brent Sass's team. Jeep is a black dog with a white patch on his chest, white toes, and a little bit of white on his muzzle, but he's mostly black with flopped over ears. Jeep is 6 years old, according to Sass. He's exactly 59 pounds, the heaviest on the team, but he wasn't always that big. In fact, to make him a better long-distance dog, Sass worked to bulk Jeep up, getting him to gain about 10 pounds just in the last year. And Jeep has an interesting story with a special connection for Brent Sass. I'll let him explain.
He was actually a Joey Reddington dog, so he's got a real connection to this race. Joey was a sprint musher, and he passed away a few years ago, but he was one of my main mentors, and he lives in Manly Hot Springs, lived in Manly Hot Springs, his wife still does. And he did a breeding 4 years ago. It was kind of his last go-around of raising and training the dogs, and he loved this dog, Jeep, and always told me that this dog can run a distance race. You know, I'm confident that he has the head to do it, and he's a little bit thicker-coated than some of his other dogs, a little bigger. And so after Joey, but he's like, oh, you're never going to get the chance, though, because he's my favorite dog, you know. But after Joey passed away, I got the opportunity to buy Jeep from Pam. And we threw him in the training, and in 2019, he went in my quest, and he was a main leader throughout the whole race and got the Golden Harness Award in our win in the quest. And then this year, he went 700 miles in the quest. But his story, I mean, he had only run 16 miles, was the longest distance he had ever run by the time he was 4 years old.
Wow.
And I just threw him into my training because of Joey's intuition, you know, it's a testament to Joey and the knowledge he had about dogs and the sense he had for dogs, because he predicted that dog could do what no one else would have predicted, you know, I was just so happy to be able to give him that chance and give him that shot, and now here he is at Iditarod, and he's going to lead us out of here today, and he's one of my main leaders, and I think he'll be leading a lot of this race, so super excited to have him in the team. High energy. He's very high energy dog. You know, he's got that sprint line, you know, so he has tons of energy, and he's just a fun loving dog. You know, whenever you bring, I never bring dogs into my kennel that are adults. And I'm always raising and breeding them and training them myself, but he was a special thing. And so I had a little bit of a, like, okay, how am I going to do this? How am I going to bring a four-year-old dog and try and integrate him into my team? And he did amazing. It was awesome how he just settled right into the team and became a team member really fast and got along with all the dogs. And he can loose run with everybody else. And just an amazing dog to have in the team. Lots of positive energy, and he just always wants to go.
Looks like he's ready.
Yeah, he's definitely ready.
That was reigning Yukon Quest champ Brent Sass talking about his lead dog, Jeep. You can find photos of the dogs and all kinds of other things Iditarod at alaskapublic.org. And that is all the time we have for today. We'll be back with another episode of the Iditapod tomorrow. Our theme music, it's by the band Sassafras. I'm your host, Casey Grove. Until next time, happy trails.
Out. Anyway, so Queso, this is your favorite auntie from Bloomington, Indiana, Stacy. And my question is, when a dog is retired, what happens to it? And what becomes of the puppies who are not up to snuff to be on the team?
You hear about dogs, especially when they're getting older and it's time to retire, they actually get adopted by other people. And somebody that I used to work with here, actually, their pet dog is a former dog from a dog mushing team. And I think that's the same case with the puppies and stuff. They will either sell them to other, you know, sled dog teams, or they'll adopt them out in most cases.
Oh, good, good. You know, I just wondered because, you know, I am a long-time animal lover, and I just wondered because they are so, I love watching them jump and leap and bark and the whole shebang.
Yeah, yeah, that's the best part is the dogs, for sure.
Oh, yeah, and I love the story about Queen Sarah Jane, that she sleeps with her musher, whose name I don't know, but boy, I know the dog's name.
Meredith Mates.
Anyway.
Yeah.
Yep. Love you, Casey. I got to go take my car to the car place.
Okay, love you too. Thanks for calling.
Oh, yeah. Bye-bye.
Bye.